Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Episode of Wild Wild Podcast, and I'd like to welcome my good friend Rod. I think I can hopefully call him my good friend Rod by now.
You should be able to, yes.
Yeah, welcome to the podcast, Rod. We've been doing this now for nearly 2 years, can you believe?
Wild Wild Podcast is 2 years old now?
Not quite, but it's not far off.
Oh, well, congratulations to us, and a happy birthday to the podcast.
Yeah. Yes, I'm sure we'll have a proper celebration when it comes around. I'm imagining, though, that around the same sort of time, there will be a lot of other podcasts celebrating 2 years because of how many people started podcasts in lockdown.
Okay, very, very good point. You're right.
Yeah. So just before we hit record, Rod and I were just celebrating / lamenting all the great stuff that's been announced in the last few weeks for the Black Friday sales. And, of course, we're looking primarily at pretty much mainly just looking at Severin, at what they've been announcing in the last few days. I mean, there's a couple of pretty obvious candidates for me, but was there anything there for you, Rod, where you thought, oh no, now I'm going to have to buy that?
Oh, well, the most obvious one is they somehow, thank goodness, got their hands on Dario Argento's Four Flies on Grey Velvet, which is something that has eluded the Blu-ray collecting community in the United States anyway for ever. And I think it's great that as is typical with films that people are waiting for years to reach a certain format. A friend of mine did finally purchase, I think, the German Blu-ray recently. Just, I mean, within the past few weeks. And of course, as soon as he does this, that of course, you know, the bell gets rung. So good for him for suffering for the rest of us.
I don't know the history behind this film at all, because people talk about it being a lost film, which I don't quite understand, because I've had it on Blu-ray for years.
Where's your Blu-ray from?
I got the Shameless release that came out over here about 10 years ago. But I don't know if there's something wrong with that one or if the quality's not forgiven. I watched it and I thought it was great. I really enjoyed it. But I know people talk about this being the lost film. So I don't know whether it's because the negative was lost or the rights were in limbo. Or I don't know what exactly has been the issue around this one.
You know, but I've forgotten. I think that at some point it was actually something to do with a rights issue, I think. Mm. But I could
be
wrong.
We'll find out.
I'll be honest. I used to know and now I do not. But
I'm sure it'll be all over Troy's commentary.
Well, I'm sure it'll actually be in the in almost anyone's commentary around the release of it on Blu-ray. Anybody with the knowledge, simply because this was a real surprise. I mean, they're also releasing his non-horror or thriller film, 5 Days in Milan, which
5 Days. Yeah,
I would like to see it one day. I don't know that I necessarily need to spend an outrageous sum of money to see it, but yeah.
Yes, because it's both of these, obviously Severin now are doing pretty much, not everything, but a lot of their stuff is getting 4K releases. And Severin, a few years ago, Severin bought their own 4K scanner, and rather than paying other people to do their scans. Mm-hmm. So now, if Severin can get their hands on stuff, they're very often scanning it themselves. And I think that shows in the number of releases they're suddenly managing to restore. Although I would imagine perhaps these Italian ones have probably been scanned in Europe. But anyway, yes, they are hot on the 4K. And to have not one, but two kind of lost films of Argento's. I would have preferred perhaps a 4K three disc edition of Dracula. That would have been nice.
Which Dracula are you talking about?
Argento's Dracula.
Ah, would you now? Yes, I think you may be one of a very small percentage of film lovers who would go along with that desire.
But, I know. Okay. I still haven't seen that, and it's quite hard to get hold of on Blu-ray. I would like to watch. But anyway, Severin, go on.
Oh, I was about to say, they're also releasing Axiom Mutante, Alex de la Iglesias film, which I think is, it's just an amazing film if you've never seen it.
Yeah. No, I don't. I'm not familiar with his stuff at all, but I know that
you're going to enjoy Severin that all one. Over it. Trust me, I'm not suggesting that you go out of your way to spend the money to go ahead and get this Blu-ray, but if you can track down a way to see that particular film, believe me, it is well worth your time.
Yeah. So, yeah, and then another surprise announcement that really caught me, and it was very well timed for our podcast, is they're going to release Luigi Cozzi's Blood on Méliès' Moon.
Yeah.
Which was only, I think it was a 2016 film. And I remember when I... the first time I managed to get to the Profondo Rosso shop when it was actually open, because they're only open like 3 hours a day, and the first time I went to Rome I never managed to get there when it was open. So a year later I went back and he wasn't around, and it's because he was off filming this movie. So it'd be nice to actually see it. I know he was selling it on DVD in his shop the last time I was there, but I didn't buy a copy, and now I'm glad I didn't, because it's getting a proper English-friendly release.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very... It's a kind of... I'm trying to think of a film to compare it to. My understanding of it is that he's playing himself, and he's filmed quite a lot of it in his own shop. So...
Really? Okay, well...
Yeah. A lot of it... If you look at the poster, and I think even the cover, it's got the Profondo Rosso store on the cover.
Oh, it does, doesn't it?
And,
wow. Okay.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, you know, these films like Nicolas Cage has just done one, and Jean-Claude Van Damme did one, where they play versions of themselves,
mm-hmm.
but then they have some kind of crazy adventure. I think it's basically like that. It's like Luigi Cozzi uncovers some kind of mystery involving Méliès and, yeah, like reality and fantasy blur around the edges. But I mean, he's been busy, because he's made at least two more films since that one, actually.
Well, what's great is apparently that Severin, the Blood on Méliès Moon Blu-ray also is going to include his 2018 film, The Little Wizards of Oz.
There you go. Yes.
So that's another one. That was made in 2018, and so
yeah.
There's also a documentary about Luigi Cozzi.
Well, this is the one. Yes, this is the reason for me, more than the films, actually. The reason to buy it is to get Fantasticozzi, the documentary from Brazil, from, I think, again, it's about 5 years old. I have not found an English-friendly copy of this documentary online. It was released. It was on Luigi Cozzi's special edition of Star Crash, has this on it. And when I bought it from him in his shop like 3-4 years ago when I was there, and he told me that the extras all had English subtitles, so I was excited and I got it home and I put it in. None of the extras had English subtitles. So I've had Fantasticozzi, but can't really watch it because my Italian is not anywhere near good enough. So yes, I'm excited to finally get to see this feature length documentary about Luigi Cozzi. I think it'll be really fun to see that. So yeah, it's also I think Severin put it on their Intervision kind of imprint, which I think means it's a bit cheaper than some of their other big box sets. It's like slightly cheaper packaging or something. But yeah, I think they've done it as an Intervision one.
I didn't check the price.
They used to,
yeah.
they used to save Intervision. It's like their old straight-to-video stuff, and they're slightly weirder things. So, but yeah, it's exciting. So I'm going to get that one at least, and maybe if we get it in time, if we get it in time, we could talk about that film as well on here, or at least I'd at least like to be able to watch it before we interview Luigi Cozzi and talk to him about that. But yeah, Severin really once again making us all cry when we think of our wallets, but at the same time very grateful that somebody is actually taking the care to find the films that people like us want to see.
Well, so it's an exciting time. Big release that they're doing, attempting to wring every nickel from me that they possibly can, is The Devil's Game, the Italian television six 1 hour long films, a little anthology series that came out in 81, which comprises the big news is that it actually has the very last work done by Mario Bava, which is exciting.
It's amazing. I'd forgotten about that one, but you're right, that's possibly the most significant out of all those releases in terms of sort of film history, to be able to complete. I mean, I'll say complete. There's probably at least one or two Bava films that we still don't have, but yeah, certainly stuff like that. I know there was another TV thing he did in the 60s. It was part of an anthology show about mythology, I want to say. I can't remember what it was called. And I know that one's quite hard to get hold of, but the fact that this has come out, it always gives you hope, doesn't it? When you see stuff like this,
exactly.
It immediately makes you think, ooh, what about this? What about this? I mean, it makes me want to petition Severin to put out Antonio Margheriti's Treasure Island in Outer Space.
Oh, man. If we're going to start digging into Italian television presentations, that is...
Like, if they can do this, they could... Because presumably it was with Rai, because everything is with Rai.
Yeah, it was a Rai TV presentation.
So if they've got Rai connections... I mean, that is a bottomless well of excitement.
And we should tell people what that means. We're saying. It's
Rai TV.
Yeah.
It's like the state. It's the state broadcaster in Italy, like the BBC.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you have an equivalent in America.
We're not talking about someone who's just subsisting simply on a bottle of booze a day or something. No.
Yes.
The thing is, what I would love, and this is just me shouting to the stars and hoping for the best, but not just... Treasure Island in Space, but the full length version of You're the Hunter from the Future would be a dream come true. To be honest, when I start talking about Mario Bava and the things that aren't particularly available or easily available, I'm still stunned to this day that there hasn't been, it has to be some kind of money issue, but there hasn't been a release of the two Steve Reeves Hercules movies. Which just stuns me because those are the films that kicked off the entire peplum cycle, and Mario Bava was heavily involved in both of those films, and it's a clear way to make just boatloads of cash. And
I know, if you really flag up the Bava connection, and even at the time, although he's not very well remembered now, the director of those films, is it Cotofavi? Is that his name?
I honestly can't remember. I'm sorry.
He was very highly regarded throughout Europe at the time as a kind of artist and craftsman, in much the same way that we now think of Bava. At the time, he was thought of as the great sort of artist of popular cinema at the time. But I think it's because his name has perhaps fallen out of favour, and most people, because Bava's name isn't on the poster, maybe that's why it's not attracted attention. But absolutely, the Hercules films belong back in the canon and back out there on people's shelves.
Oh, definitely. That's why I'm always... I mean, I'm stunned. We're in 2022. We're more than a decade, or we're a decade or more into the high definition disc wave of releases, and that still hasn't made its way to us. Yeah. I'm just really surprised. It has to have something to do with either or both a quality of materials issue, or a pricing issue for whoever holds the rights.
And I think, my kind of reading of it is that there's just not the same level of cult demand for peplum films.
But those two movies, I mean,
Italian horror. I mean, I know
those are the those are the biggies. Everybody knows them. Who knows anything at all about those kinds of movies? I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, there were only when I did my PhD, I wrote about these films a lot. And at the time, I think in the 60s, there were only two. Let me get this right. There were only two non-English and non-Hollywood movies that were in the top 10 of the UK box office in the whole of the 60s. I think that's right. One of them was Hercules Unchained, and the other one was The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Wow.
Those two films made the top 10 box office during the 60s, and they were the only kind of non, even though they would have been released with English dubs, but they were the only non-British / Hollywood film. So they, yeah, I mean, those films were massive. But I just think now, if you're a cult Blu-ray label, you're going to stick out some more old horror, or, you know, because the sort of demand, I guess they feel just the demand isn't there. I know a while ago, Kino, I've probably mentioned this on the podcast before, Kino announced like 2 years ago or more that they were going to put out Goliath and the Vampires.
Oh.
Which is a great, one of the few X-rated Peplum films. And it's great. It is a fabulous film. And Bava was involved with that as well, and his dad, mm-hmm. I think, because his dad was a sculptor. But that Blu-ray is kind of announced and then vanished. And
yeah, I don't even remember it being announced.
I was excited because it's another one that I'd covered and I'd written about, so I was really excited that somebody was going to put out a decent copy. But no, that disappeared. I don't know. There doesn't seem to be the appetite for it, which there should be. And I think with the right marketing, you could big it up and say these films are important.
Oh, I agree. They are. It's not like we're, it's not like we're stepping out on a limb to make these kinds of, you know, bold statements about films that are not particularly well thought of in certain circles. No, that's not it at all. These movies are major stepping stones in hugely profitable cycles of entire genres. And the fact that they're, you know, like I say, it cannot be that there's someone out there who is honestly in this business and is turning up their nose at it. It has to be a question of money or materials. That's the only thing that makes any sense to me, because man, those movies were huge. And regardless of whether, you know, any of the peplums that followed in their wake would make, you know, would sell X number of copies or whatever, you know, whatever it would take to make it an enticing thing for a label to bring out those movies, those movies would sell. I mean, they're of historical significance, especially if they made a big splash to make sure that people were aware of them as they were putting them out, because it's just, they're big.
Yeah. I know we should probably be talking about this stuff next week, because we're actually going to do some Hercules films.
Oh, that's right.
Week.
And I'm kind of excited. Yeah, you're right.
We're a week ahead. Yeah. But I mean, again, I don't know. I keep repeating myself. I might have said this before as well. But a few years ago, Arrow were interested in possibly putting together a Peplum box set. And they asked me for some advice on cult, like Peplum films with cult appeal, because obviously that's the hook. And so I recommended The Vampires 1. And obviously the first two Hercules films, and also the Ruggero Deodato Margheriti Peplum film, Hercules Prisoner of Evil. Mm-hmm. Like, you could, if you get it right, you could pitch these and cult fans would go for it. But anyway, such is sadly not the case. But still, this is this is the problem when you get companies announce stuff. I mean, you can always see this in the comments on Facebook, but whenever Severin's announced some amazing long lost title, you look at the comments below and within about 5 minutes, what about this film
well, I mean, it's kind of natural, you can't help it.
Yeah, you can't help it, can you?
Yeah, there's no way to avoid that. I mean, that, you know, look what conversation this has fueled just between the two of us talking about these things, and then spread that out to, you know, thousands and thousands of other people, and it just gets out sort of control.
It must be annoying if you're Severin or somebody like that, and you've announced this thing, and then people are immediately asking you for other things.
Well, I mean, what have you done for me in a year is essentially what it sounds like, you know.
Exactly. What have the Romans ever done for us? But yes, anyway, Severin have got some exciting stuff coming up if you've got a load of money ready. And I haven't seen anything from Vinegar Syndrome. I don't know.
Well, they're putting some stuff out. I can't remember.
I don't know if there's anything relevant for us, really, that in terms of like cult Italian.
No, I don't think so.
I don't think there is, which is kind of a relief because I don't think I can afford to do both companies this year.
So, well, having just spent a ridiculously stupid amount of money on the Bollywood box set that that Mondo released on Halloween.
Is that out already? I missed
it. Oh, well, the pre-order's out. I mean, you can go still get it from them, but it won't come out. Oh. It won't actually hit anybody's doorstep until the 1st of 2023. I wanted to get that one.
That's another one to add to my...
Oh, yeah, I'm very excited
anyway,
about that. Yeah,
that'll be fun. so many films, so little time. I like to think of, I think it was Vince... who used to say on the B-Movie cast that you couldn't die until you'd watched every film in your collection.
Oh, then I'll live forever.
Sadly, didn't quite turn out to be the case for lovely Vince, but
yeah,
There's still hope. Which I guess, let's move on to our topic for today. And I think one of the first times I became aware of you, Rod, was through your... voicemails and letters to Vince's podcast.
Oh, well, yeah.
I guess the B-Movie cast brought a lot of us people from around the world together in different ways. And one of the first letters I remember him, or maybe it was a voicemail you left.
Oh, it was definitely a voicemail, trust me.
Yeah, it was a voicemail, and it was like a joke. I think it was a joke. Some kind of comedy spat between you and Derek Cook about Godzilla films.
Yes, yes.
And this went on for a number of weeks. Sort of back and forth on the B-Movie cast about Godzilla films. So I think that's an excellent sort of jumping off point for our conversation today, where we're going to talk about Luigi Cozzi's potentially ill-advised updating of Godzilla. Before we get into that, I wanted to ask you if you want, without taking up the next 2 or 3 hours, if you want to just tell us a little bit about your affection for or your sort of history with Godzilla.
Oh, well, I mean, I think I went through what I would refer to as the standard child of my generation's, love and loss and love again relationship with the Godzilla films and the character himself. And by that, I refer to, I think, when you're a kid and you're growing up in, in the 60s, 70s or 80s, there's a love that you have as a youngster that kind of parallels, especially little boys' love of dinosaurs. It kind of, they go hand in hand in a way that, I wonder if the Toho Meisters actually foresaw, or was it just a bit of genius, accidental on their part? But the standard way in which these things go is this is how it went for me, is you're a kid, you love this stuff, you really get into it, you support it and love it in a way that completely blinds you to flaws or concerns or strangeness or how odd this stuff is. It's, you love it the same way you love the fact that the Easter Bunny exists. You're just glad it's there and hallelujah, whoo, this is fun. And then you become an adult and you think, I shall cast away childish things. And you turn your nose up and you sneer at such,
you sneer at such
cinematic silliness, and you move forward into the world as a...
Start watching Ingmar Bergman films.
Exactly. You start talking about the great films from Japan, and they revolve around Kurosawa and all these other, you see floating weeds and you think, yes. Classic Japanese cinema. That's what it is. Wonderful, heartfelt, well acted dramas.
Yeah. I've never watched any of those. I think I missed out this phase, Rod. I skipped straight from childhood into back into the stuff.
Well, see, that's very just little it. Gap in between. I think that many things have altered this phase now, and I don't know that it still exists. So I'm kind of talking about a form of Godzilla fandom that, you know, may be in the archives now. I'm not sure, but the moment somewhere in my 20s when I realized that not watching Godzilla films and not enjoying these kinds of things was really freaking stupid, and I don't know exactly what it was, but I shifted back into. You know, the world can't tell me what's good and what's bad, and I'll watch an Akira Kurosawa film right next to a Godzilla movie, and I won't care. It won't be any concern to me. I'll watch the fantastic and the realistic right next to each other, and I don't care.
You're probably going to say the same point as
well. Oh, well, yeah. And of course, all of this points to around the period of time where it becomes easier to see the original film, the 1954 film, the original Gojira, the un-Americanized version of the film. And you realize that it was a very realistic film as far as portraying the human beings on screen. It was a very serious film. It wasn't meant to be childish or silly. Yes, yeah. It's a dark.
It's quite depressing.
Yeah. It's a dark film, and it, not to spoil a film that is, you know, extraordinarily old at this point. But I mean, the film's hero is a scientist. You know, big points there. Who sacrifices his own life to destroy this monster and save his nation. He's a hero who gives his life for his country and for the people that he loves. And that's the end of the film. that's the upshot of that movie. And if, you know, having been someone who grew up on the Americanized version, it was a bit of a shock to realize that, you know, Perry Mason wasn't really in it. And to know that there was a version of this film out there that really kind of signaled how the changes in the series as it went along came about. And it's like, oh, wow, we really start off with not just an extremely high point, but also where you're dealing with filmmakers who are making a serious movie. Not that it isn't entertaining. It's incredibly entertaining. I mean, you don't make a film that spawns decades of sequels of every type.
Well, and invents a whole genre, really, doesn't it? There's a whole genre they invented.
Exactly. I mean,
I suppose it's partly the move to color as well that sort of signaled a slightly different, a shift in emphasis. Was when they became colorful, they become much more about entertainment, I think.
Maybe so. Maybe so.
With Godzilla versus King Kong,
but that doesn't stop the filmmakers as they went along, especially throughout the Toho run of those Godzilla films. Is almost every one of those films is going to have some kind of what should be an underlayer, what should be subtext that sometimes just becomes text because they're just going to say it out loud because they want to make sure. You know, the Smog Monster
that's the one I was going to say. That's one of my favorites. Is that Godzilla versus, is it
Hedorah? Hedorah, yeah.
Yeah, the Smog Monster. I love that
film.
It's
a great film.
I think it's fab.
Yeah.
That the, like you said, the subtext is just the text.
Yeah.
But on top of that, you've got all the groovy dancing and the sort of 60s theme nightclubs and Godzilla can fly.
Of the strange colors and it's an amazing film, and what's great is that the series went on for, especially even that initial run, the Showa series, the ones that span from 54 to I think 75, you can look at those films and there's so much weird variety in the in the films, and that's without even talking about the offshoot films like the first Mothra and War of the Gargantuas, and you know all these you know all the other kaiju films that Toho was making that didn't necessarily directly connect to Godzilla.
Well, and then people like Toei getting into that stuff, and Ultraman, and just so much men in suit action. I was going to make the point as well in regards to what you were saying about you know, respectability. The world catches up with you eventually, because all the Godzilla films of this period are Criterion films now, you know. So
yeah,
they're taking these films seriously, and they're not just silly entertainment, although they are that as well, a lot of them. But yeah, that first film, what I think is interesting, so we'll get into the backstory of how this connects to Luigi Cozzi, but yeah, the message is very they state it in the film that Godzilla was brought to the surface because through repeated nuclear testing, and this was a criticism of the American government, basically, because it was the Americans doing the nuclear testing in the Pacific.
Yeah.
And this had caused problems in real life. There'd been a fishing vessel that had been affected by one of the things, like a Bikini Atoll test, which is how they then start the original Godzilla, is with a fishing vessel getting affected by something nuclear, something radiated coming out of the sea. And so, like you said, it's not even subtext. And that one of the scientists, he's an anthropologist, and he wants to study Godzilla and understand how he wasn't killed by the radiation. And he says, when they kill Godzilla, he says there will be more, because, you know, we do more nuclear testing in the ocean, this is what's going to happen. So it's very kind of ecologically minded. They talk about Godzilla's natural habitat being destroyed, and that's what's brought him to the surface. And so it's almost like a, you know, it's like an environmental film, and it's a very critical of the, well, nuclear in general, but also the specifically what the Americans were doing. And that's really interesting. That's all happening less than 10 years after the end of the Second World War, and obviously with everything that happened there. And it's got sort of shades of the destruction of parts of Japan, you know, Hiroshima and all those kind of things. But then what I find interesting with Luigi Cozzi's version is that, in case that stuff wasn't obvious enough, he puts in real footage.
Yes.
Of real Hiroshima and war. And yeah, so should we get to the story of, yeah, what's this all got to do with Luigi Cozzi?
Yeah, I think that's probably a good idea, because I'm sure there are people who, honestly, this will be their introduction to the fact that this exists at all.
What are they're listening to the wrong podcast. What suddenly happened? So Cozzi was always a fan of sci-fi and fantasy. That was his first love. And he'd made a few films. So we talked about The Killer Must Kill Again. And then he made a sex comedy as well. And then he made a film which I also haven't seen, called The Last Concert, also known as Stella.
Yeah.
Starring Richard Johnson. Have you seen that one?
No, but it's one that I want to see. I'm very curious about it.
He talks about that being his favorite of all of his films, actually. He thinks it's his best of his films. Yeah, I need to see that one. But it was a big hit. And so he teamed up with a friend called Renato Barbieri, who was also a sci-fi fan. And they founded what they called the BBC, which is in the credits of this Godzilla, and I found that very confusing. It feels like the BBC, but it's not that BBC. They formed a company called the BBC, and it doesn't say in the book. I'm using the book about Cozzi, called Written and Directed by Lewis Coates, and it just calls it the BBC. I'm assuming that one of those B's is for Barbieri, and the C must be for Cozzi, but I don't know what the other B is for. But anyway, they formed this company with the idea of preserving and releasing classic sci-fi. So through that company, let's see, I've got a list here of the films that he released. So he released in Italian cinemas films like Silent Running, Lord of the Flies, Cat People, The Day of the Triffids, Invaders from Mars, Radar Men from the Moon, Quatermass Experiment, Destination Moon. So a whole load of those. And so I think Godzilla kind of is one of those. He tried to get the rights. I read somewhere that originally he wanted to do Gorgo, the British kind of Godzilla type film, but he couldn't get the rights for that. But he contacted Toho, and they gave him the rights to distribute Godzilla in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
But they gave him the American King of the Monsters version, which was 80 minutes long. And in Italy, you had to have your film had to be a minimum 90 minutes long to be shown in cinemas. So that was his first problem. And then when he tried it out with cinema owners, they didn't want to show a film that was in black and white.
Yeah.
So he'd got this problem.
Not in the 70s, yeah.
No. So he'd got two problems. He'd got a film that was too short, and it was in black and white. But he'd paid $7,000 apparently to Toho, which was a lot of money in those days. So he wanted to do something with it. He needed to get the film out there. And so that was where he came up with a plan, kind of two plans. One was to do some editing with this version, but the other one was to colorize it. And
When you say colorize, we should probably mention that you're putting air quotes around that word.
So he met this guy. What was his name? Armando Valcauda, whose name might sound familiar, and that's because he did a lot of the special effects for Star Crash.
Yeah.
So he met this guy in Turin, and this guy was an artist and filmmaker and had some ideas, and he said he could colorize it. And Luigi said, I read somewhere, it took him about 3 months. He spent 3 months working on this film to create, basically it's like three strips of color that change through the movie. It's not colorized like, you know, they haven't painted every frame.
No.
Like, again, going back to Georges Méliès, which is what he would do. Like, it's kind of funny that the color in Méliès' Trip to the Moon is better than the color in this. That's 70 years later.
I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but yeah, you're right.
You know, if you look at the if you find the colorized version of Trip to the Moon, it's fabulous because it's all hand painted, whereas this, it's like been dipped in some kind of psychedelic dye. But the idea was that it would fit with what was on the screen, which is why I guess it took him so long.
Yeah.
The only place for me where the colorization worked is when there is fire. I don't know what you thought.
Yeah, that's true. I can see what you're... Yeah, you're not wrong.
He's colored that bit of the screen orange. So that kind of works. But for the rest of the time, it's just weird colors all over.
The rest of the time, it feels like someone has popped, you know, some kind of psychedelic drug into your tea, man. It's just weird.
Yeah. It's like the sort of psychedelic light shows of the 60s, the sort of acid-inspired oil slide shows and stuff, but on a film. Although in Luigi's book, there's an interview with him and he mentions it, and he says Godzilla is the world's first colorized film.
No,
which again,
maybe,
given that Méliès was doing it, maybe the world's first film colorized like this.
Or colorized by people who had nothing to do with the production. That might be part. Maybe that's a way to phrase it. I don't know.
But it's not. I mean, I wouldn't really call it colorized. Like back in the 80s, they were doing colorized versions of Laurel and Hardy films. And they didn't look great, but they still looked better than this.
Well, it took a long time for people to get the colorization process into a place where it wasn't immediately vomit-inducing.
They called it Spectrorama 70,
which means sounds more impressive than it is.
Yeah, they put it on the poster. One of the best things about this release is the poster.
Oh, the poster!
They did a brand new poster, and it looks great. And it does say Spectrorama 70 mm-hmm. on it. In fact, that poster image, which I'll tweet out at some point, was on the very first cover of Fangoria. So. That's its legacy, I guess. Fangoria used it on their Godzilla issue, which was the first ever issue. So that's worth noting. But yeah, so it's got this Spectrorama 70 look to it. But that wasn't the only thing. Let's not forget, he still had to fill it with an extra 10 minutes of stuff.
Right.
So were you able to spot the joins when you watched it?
No, it was seamless, Adrian. I couldn't tell. It felt so natural. No, of course I could spot the joints. My God.
So, yeah. I mean, do you want to describe? Can you describe what some of the stuff was that he put in?
There are a number of things. All of them. Some of them you can understand. He's looking for certain sequences in the film. He's looking for footage that can marry together, almost match some of this stuff that goes down once the city destruction starts happening. So he stole footage from films like The Day the Earth Caught Fire and Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, and even from Godzilla Raids Again, apparently. And kind of wedge them in there to kind of lengthen the film out a little bit. But the most, Do I want to use the word questionable, or do I want to use the word?
It's certainly jarring is a word I would use as well.
Yeah, is his use of stock newsreel footage, stock real footage from the atomic attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki that are. Don't get me wrong, they do serve a good purpose in getting, kind of hammering that nail home about what drove the filmmakers in Japan to create this picture.
It's not even hammering; it's like bludgeoning.
Yeah, it is. it feels like the mistake of a young man thinking that if I hit you really, 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 really hard, you'll remember it instead of it just being something that you go. That's a moron doing this to me, isn't it? This takes me so far out of the picture that I can't get back into it.
Sometimes you hear Luigi Cozzi being described as the Italian Ed Wood, which I don't know if that's like meant affectionately or as an insult.
I wouldn't agree with that, but I can see the point.
No, but I wouldn't. But what I thought of was that bit in the movie of Ed Wood when he's in the studio and he's looking at somebody who's got all this stock footage that they're running through.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, if I had access to all this, I could just I'd cut it together and make a movie. And it's what this feels like. It's like,
at times,
he's just kind of cut all this stuff together to make a movie without any real thought of whether it was appropriate or not. But it's not even like he warms you up to it. I think the film opens.
It starts with it.
With it, which is really weird. And then it cuts in and out through the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But and there's sort of footage of so there's people, there's destruction, there's dead bodies, there's like battle footage or footage after a battle, there's soldiers, dead bodies lying all over the streets.
Yeah.
I swear I saw one corpse without a head. And like this is, you know, this is a film that children were probably going to in the cinema. And he's got all this with this like grim footage, but then still with all this psychedelic color all over the top.
The thought that floated through my mind was, you know, a child in Italy goes to see a giant lizard rampage film and ends up accidentally seeing Cronenberg's The Fly. It's just like, what are we doing here?
I know. They're like crying as they come out of the cinema and they don't quite know why they're crying. But another thing that's interesting with this is primarily he's using the American print and the score that came with that. But he did also get some additional music to help.
Yeah.
Cover the gaps, part of which was provided by a band called Magnetic System,
mm-hmm.
which is I think they were just made up for this one thing.
I think so as well.
But interestingly, one member of Magnetic System, and I will be dropping the song in. In fact, let's do it now. I'm going to play it now. In case it sounds familiar, that's because one member of the band was Fabio Frizzi.
Yeah.
And this is only about 2 years before his iconic score for Zombie Flesh Eaters. So,
and you may have noticed kind of some similarities there.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember in an interview I saw with him where he talked about how he created the sort of bass drum beat for that Zombie Flesh Eater score. And he basically just did it by tapping a microphone. And it sounds like that in this one as well. So I don't know if that's, but yeah. So that music plays over this horrendous, like disturbing footage of Hiroshima.
And it's right at the beginning of the film. It's right at the beginning, which I mean, and that's the thing. I don't know how many times I've watched Dracula. I mean, I don't know how many times I've watched various films over the years. I just, you know, you lose track as you go along.
Yeah.
But I know I've seen the original Godzilla a dozen times at bare minimum. And to have this version of it crank up with an extraordinarily modern synth score over, you know, film footage of atrocities is very disturbing.
it's unexpected.
And the thing is,
Wait a minute, psychedelic footage of atrocities.
Yes, yes. Well, the thing is, if I were going to praise nothing else in this movie, I would say that I actually do like the new music that's in it. Although I do not know that it is necessarily appropriate for this picture, I do like the music. And we should point out that Vince Tempura, is another one of the trio who was part of this this musical group that came together to create this music for this. And he's a name that pops up again and again for me because he did scores for some films that I'm very fond of, like Lucio Fulci's For the Apocalypse, and also Silver Saddle, the Lucio Fulci Western. And even some of his later stuff, although I don't know, I know that some of his theme for Seven Notes in Black got recycled by Quentin Tarantino in the first Kill Bill film. So he is a talent of real note. But the music, I would like to set that to the side and say, you know, I like that. I do like that.
So. Yeah. Well, it was released as there was a 7-inch single at the time, which is now highly collectible if you can find it.
Yeah, save yourself some trouble, people. You can hear the music online. You don't have to spend a ton of money.
So Coetzee also he wanted to do something like Sensurround, which was the sort of rumbling bass thing that made people's teeth fall out and felt ill when they were watching films like Earthquake. You know, you hear all these horror stories about people watching Earthquake and having their insides shaken to bits. And he wanted to do something similar, but he couldn't do that and he couldn't afford it. Because obviously he couldn't install special equipment or anything. So basically, if you look at the credits, he's got something that says it's in Future Sound. And I think that's basically just a high bass. Basically, the bass is quite high in the mix. So I imagine he just got them to turn it up in the theatres and the bass pummeled them a little bit as the buildings are crashing down and the Godzilla, you know, roars and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, so he's got Future Sound and what did I say the thing was? Spectrorama 70. But yeah, you're right. It's basically just William Castling. It just making up names of formats that don't exist but sound good.
Yes, exactly. And don't get me wrong, I'm all for it. But those are the kinds of stunts that would get you kind of laughed at by other filmmakers and film producers who, you know, look upon that as, you know, the kind of thing from a bygone age. I mean, yeah, we're referencing the stuff that big studios did with films like Earthquake, which were, you know, relatively recently. I mean, they were only a few years before this, so they were still. There was still the occasional bizarre thing of that type, and honestly, we weren't. You know, we were only a few years away from Hollywood deciding that it was a good idea to bring 3D back and see how that worked out in the early 80s. Little hint, it didn't. Yeah. Little hint, it didn't work out.
I mean, the visuals of this film, it kind of looks like you could probably stick 3D glasses on and it might do something.
You know, maybe.
It's all the sort of green fuzzy colors. So, Rod, what did the Japanese think of this film when they saw what he'd done? And I should add, it was a big hit. Actually, he made his money back and made a profit in Italy.
He made some cash. So,
and there's a great photo, which I shall try and remember to tweet out as well in this book, of a big front of a cinema somewhere in Italy in 1977. That says Godzilla on the marquee, and it's actually got his name on it as well. It says Luigi Coetzee presents Godzilla. So he was managing to get his name out there. This is 1977, so that's the same year as Star Crash. And so he's becoming known as a director and now as a distributor. So he's got his name on the front. So he did all right with it in Italy. But yeah, what did Toho think when they saw what he'd done?
They clapped their hands. They were filled with joy. I'm lying.
They loved it.
They despised it. While apparently they had signed a contract with Coetzee that allowed him to do what he wanted to, and therefore there's not much they could say about, you know, what he had done to their movie, they squashed this pretty hard. They tried to get it like deleted from reality to a certain degree. you're not allowed to mention the film in any of the Toho approved stuff that references Godzilla or any of the films. I mean, from what I've read, and this does not surprise me, that references to it were taken out of the Blu-ray commentary for the Criterion release of the original Godzilla a few years back, which, if we're going to go that far.
I haven't listened to that, but I'm imagining just they're just talking and then suddenly just Birdsong kicks in.
Well, see, that's for that, about 2 minutes. I have listened to that commentary track, but it was back when that Blu-ray first came out, and you know everybody was it was so wonderful to have a high definition version of the original Gojira, and I have listened to commentary tracks from that set, and it's just there's this realization now that's like, oh wow, so some of those silent spots maybe weren't necessarily something that I think August Ragone is one of the ones who was involved in that. I just like, maybe not have been planned. Okay,
it's a shame, but yeah, they sort of I think they had hopes that if this had worked, it would be an opportunity for them to, you know, to sort of release it in other territories and make some money. Because obviously, as well as we've mentioned the music, we've mentioned the image, but he did also dub it. So it's a new Italian dub as well.
Which, you know, would have been necessary. I mean, that's the way of things in the 1970s,
so you've got Raymond Burr speaking Italian now. Do you think you'll know the Raymond Burr version better than me, because that's the version I guess you grew up watching.
Well,
do you think is it all there? Like, has he taken any of that stuff out, or do you think it's pretty much all left in?
That is a fantastic question. I'll be honest with you. I have not watched the American version of Godzilla in a very long time. I mean, I do have it as part of the, you know, kind of the Godzilla collection. I do have access to it, but I'll be honest, anytime I feel the need to go back and watch that first film, I always default to the original version. So it has been a long time. The last time I probably watched it was on videotape, to be blunt.
Right.
Which means it was a long time ago.
It's really funny how they've cut together scenes where he's having a conversation with two of the Japanese characters.
Yeah.
And you're just seeing them with just the backs of their heads, he's talking to them. That made me laugh a lot.
It's kind of clever that they got away.
But I guess
they
it
got
worked.
Away with it. Yeah. I mean, for 1956, these were the kind of slick tricks that were pretty common in Hollywood at the time. Anyway, when you know scheduling difficulties made it impossible to get certain actors on the same sound stage at the same time, but let's put it this way. The American version of the film is a perfectly acceptable way to see the story. It just isn't the film as originally intended. No. And in all honesty, there's no reason to have an American journalist character, you know, popping up to go, oh my goodness. And, you know, just reporting back to America about all the horrors that are occurring. It's just like, my feeling now is that if I went back and watched it, I would feel like it was getting in the way.
There is a connection here as well back to where we started with Hercules Unchained, because Godzilla was picked up for international distribution by Joseph E. Levine, and it was him that turned it into Godzilla King of the Monsters.
Oh, yeah.
He made all his money from Godzilla, and then that sort of pushed him to go and find other films that he could buy cheaply and then exploit. And so that's why in 1959... He came back to America with, you know, with a can under his arm with Hercules Unchained,
mm-hmm.
and he, you know, he dubbed it and he spent millions on the marketing, pushed it really hard, and the same here in the UK, made it a massive hit. So, although I think with that one he didn't change anything except the soundtrack. I guess he didn't feel the need to put... So it would have been quite funny, actually, wouldn't it? If you're watching Hercules Unchained and Raymond Burr turns up in the middle.
they would have to colorize the footage somehow.
Yeah. But no, he didn't feel the need to film anything extra. Actually, one thing I noticed in the credits for our Godzilla we're talking about today is that it mentions two directors. It mentions the Japanese original director. Then you've got the... So that was Ishiro Honda. Then it mentions Terry Morse as well, who filmed the King of the Monster segments. And then it says, like, new footage, Luigi Cozzi. But as far as I could tell, there was no new footage. So I don't know what that referred to. As far as I can tell, it's all just the existing footage plus all those extra bits that we've talked about already.
Yeah,
it didn't look to me like there was anything new.
Yeah, I didn't. I'm not aware of it. Yeah,
yeah. No, I don't know, but it says in the credits new footage.
We should point out that probably the reason that, I mean, besides just being a fan of Godzilla movies, that Coetzee may have thought that this was going to be a great success, and it, you know, he did he did make money. Don't get me wrong. Was because remember, just the year before, 1976, the big De Laurentiis remake of King Kong had come out. And regardless of your opinions of it, it did make money. And it was a huge hit, and it was a worldwide success to a degree. And so there's a you know, what I love is that for everyone who's thinking, my God, what a weird thing to do in 1977. Yeah. I mean, the year Star Wars came out, someone is colorizing and bastardizing the original Gojira and putting it out in Italian theaters. And it's like, yes, you have to, you know, you need kind of a little wider view on what was going on in cinemas at the time. And
It does make you wonder why he didn't just try and buy the rights to a more recent Godzilla film that was already in color. But I guess he didn't realize it was going to be a problem until after he bought this one. So it's like he was saving a bad situation. He'd already spent the money and then found out that it needed to be in color.
And then found out that it needed to be 10 minutes longer.
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. Although, of course, some of those other films that he was distributing were black and white as well, and he didn't colorize those, so I don't... Who knows? I don't know. Anyway, I don't know. We can ask him. We'll ask him. So although it was squashed and it will never have an official release, it is out there. There are very poor quality copies on YouTube. I managed to find a slightly better version than the one that's on YouTube using your... what you call the special antenna.
Yes.
So it's watchable, the version that I found. It's better than the YouTube one, but obviously it's the best we're going to get. They're never going to go back to the negative and say, here's, that would be, imagine that next Black Friday, Severin say, and here's Luigi Godzi's Godzilla.
That would,
in a three disc 4K special edition. That's never going to happen.
That's not going to happen.
But it's worth, if you're curious, I mean, with all these things, it's worth checking it out. Because there's nothing else quite like it, for better or worse, really.
It's unique. Let's put it that way. Yeah. It's certainly a unique bit of Godzilla cinema history.
It is, and it's good. It's interesting. It's a good way of sort of getting your head around Coetzee's career and what he was doing and what he was interested in. And this is, you know, this was part of his side project, if you like, of distributing old films. Because he basically just loved them. You know, he made this, for all its faults, he made it out of love. So,
This is a, and I'm not using this word I'm about to use as a pejorative. So this is not meant as an insult. This is one of the most obvious fanboy projects I can imagine. This is someone who got the chance to bring something he loves to a mass audience in his home country.
Yeah.
And he did the things that he felt he needed to do to create something that would not, you know, would not just make money, but also I'm sure he felt, you know, actually brought the thing that he loved to a wider audience. And that is admirable in a cockeyed way. You have to be impressed no matter how psychotic the viewing experience is these days. It's a strange little, it's a strange little cul-de-sac in the history of Godzilla cinema. And it is, rightfully difficult to find. It exists on, you know, the Internet Archive. You can find it there. You can find it in various old places. It's never going to look good, as we spoke about a second ago. But the strange nature of it. I look upon this, the existence of it, as evidence of just how pervasive the love of kaiju film is. It's such a joy that it can cause people to make gargantuan artistic mistakes. This is evidence of that. It wasn't, you know, the first time someone, you know, made a humongous era was not 1998 in America, friends. It was this, which I have a lot more respect for, to be honest with you, because at least it does demonstrate a real love for the actual films themselves.
Absolutely. And Luigi's love of genre is evident through all his films, as we've obviously mentioned. And next time, we'll be looking at his Hercules films back-to-back, one and two. I think two is quite a lot of it is made up from footage he shot during one anyway, so it's basically all just one big film. So, so that's what we're going to cover next time. And then we have decided, we discussed this off-air, that we're going to throw in The Black Cat as well.
Yeah, his 1989 film with Caroline Monroe.
So that'll be on the cards as well. And then we will finally, at some point, get to talk to him, all being well. But anyway, thank you so much, Rod. It's been interesting to talk about this weird experiment with you. And I hope this has been interesting for everybody. We are online. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. And you can email us as well. All the links are in the show notes, or you can find them on our Acast page. If you just Google Wild Wild Podcast, you'll find us. And, we have had somebody recently bought us a coffee. So thank you very much. If you would also like to do that, then again, the link for that is in the notes, or just go to ko-fi.com and then find Wild Wild Podcast on there. If you'd like to make a contribution and help us to keep things going, maybe you could help us to invest in our own future sound for our next episodes or whatever. I don't know. Anyway. But yes, please do get in touch with us and let us know what you think. All the links and all the addresses are in the usual places. And I'm just going around in circles now, so I think I'll stop. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Rod. And we will be back after Black Friday with no money in our pockets. Okay, thanks everybody, and we'll be back again soon.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye all.
Catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.